copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm not an expert in anything, okay? You're lawyers and politicians and so on, and I'm just a Christian minister who's really interested in these things. And I like thinking about things. I'm a historian as well. I studied history at Edinburgh University. And I don't understand why people don't like theology and why people think theology is not practical, because it's really, really practical. I'm really an evangelist, and I think the best apologetics book I've ever read, apart from the Bible, is Calvin's Institutes. So that usually puzzles people. But he was trying to reach out. He wrote it as an apologia to the King of France for the Christian gospel. So what I want to do is, we probably won't get to do all that I want to do. I want to look at this question of how good theology leads to good society, good law, and good politics. And I want to begin by just a couple of presuppositions. Beliefs. Do beliefs matter? People say we're not really into beliefs. Ideologies don't matter anymore and so on. It's complete and utter rubbish. Not least because that itself is a belief. Beliefs incredibly matter. And I think that in actual fact, the most dangerous people you will come across are people who think that their beliefs are not beliefs. It's much easier to deal with a fundamentalist Muslim than it is to deal with a fundamentalist secularist or a fundamentalist atheist. I call the new atheists the new fundamentalist atheists, and they get so upset with me. Because they say we don't have a holy book and we don't have, and I say, yeah, but you do have fundamental beliefs. And when you don't recognize your beliefs, you're in severe trouble, because what you do is you presuppose that this is the natural route for everybody. Everyone will think this. Everyone. And if people don't think, so one of the key things we're trying to do in evangelism and in outreach is to get people to think about, what do I actually believe? Now, I also want to say that in terms of politics and in terms of law, that you're asking people to think, well, why? Why? I mean, you are going to be the annoying child who's always saying to their parent, why? 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 And I think, you know, in our culture, one of the best ways to reach out to people, one of the best ways to be salt and light, is always to question. Second thing is roots and fruits I've talked about in Europe. Now, the fact is that Europe, in the providence of God, from the day that the Holy Spirit forbade Paul and his companions from heading to eastern Turkey and made them go into Greece, that Europe became a Christian continent. And the effects of that are still felt today. We still have the fruits of that. Now, I know that most people in Europe will say we don't, we're post-Christian. Or many people will think that. Well, we still live in a world that is shaped by Christian beliefs. Take a classic example. Your classic American liberal atheist will immediately, like Michael Shermer, will immediately cite Sweden as an atheistic country. Now, that is an example of profound ignorance. Sweden is a profoundly Christian country in its foundations, in its legal system, in its ethos. I accept fully that possibly around 60% would say they no longer believe in God. The roots have gone, but the fruits are still there. It's taking time for them to get rotten. I think it was last year, for the first time in the secular paradise, there were riots in cities over immigration. It'll be very interesting to see what happens in Europe today in the European elections, how much the right-wing parties, moving towards fascistic, to be honest, how many votes that they will receive. But I would argue that most people in Europe still have the Christian fruits in the sense of the ethos and the ideas and the ideologies. Now, you read someone like Michel Onfray, who's probably the best atheist writer in the world, a French guy, one of the most honest, and he is quite happy to state we need to get rid of Christianity out of medicine, out of politics, out of law, because it still permeates all these things. Most people what they consider to be kind of natural, and oh yeah, of course that's the case. In actual fact, it's not natural, it's something that they've received from Christianity. And I want to use that particularly as regards the myth of equality. And this is a key thing. The narrative in our culture from the elites and permeated through the media is that pre-Christian society, Greco-Roman society, was fundamentally democratic, philosophical, brilliant, and equal. That equality is a natural human thing. But in reality, you can... there's a guy called Sidentop who's written a book called The Inventing of the Individual, which is absolutely brilliant. And to my mind, he demonstrates absolutely clearly that the natural human condition, and he in particular is talking about in Europe, in Greco-Roman pagan Europe, the natural condition was against equality. And that equality and diversity and tolerance are the three mantras of our postmodern liberal bourgeois society. But actual fact, equality comes from Christianity. And I think that is, if you're going to take anything from this, I want you to think about that and to use that. Pre-Christian society was funded upon the beliefs that human beings are not equal. Some people are born slaves, some people are not. Radical social inequality was easier in a dumbed-down society. Now that's an important understanding. The Greeks and the Romans saw that everything was hierarchical and pyramid. Aldous Huxley in his Brave New World talks about a society where you'll have the alphas and the epsilons. You have different classes of people. Ironically, in a society, in our culture, which says that it's all for equality, we are right from birth, we are putting kids into groups. We're saying you live in this housing scheme, you're born with this background, you go to this school, and so on. There's a radical inequality that is coming as Europe rejects its Christian roots. So the thesis of what I'm saying, and not a lot of people will have thought about this too much, but the thesis of what I'm saying is equality is fundamentally a Christian concept. Now, we'll see why that is as we go on. So I'll split it into three parts. We're going to look at theology and society, and by definition, this is going to be fairly straightforward. Theology. Well, what do we mean by theology? If you're a new atheist, you say it's fairyology. What's the point? You don't need to study theology. Only idiots study theology. It's a complete waste of a discipline. You will not find a single ancient university in Europe that was not founded on the basis that people were there to study theology. You studied theology and philosophy, and only after that did you do law and medicine. In fact, I would say you're a pretty awful lawyer unless you study theology, and you're a pretty awful politician unless you know theology and philosophy. That should be the basis of education, because it's quite interesting. We have this idea now. See, I grew up, I'm a farm worker's son from the north of Scotland. My dad left school when he was 12. But I grew up in a culture in which the idea of anyone from any background being able to go to university to get an education was the idea. That is rapidly disappearing. Now you go to university to get a qualification, to get a degree for a job. And that's a dreadful shame, because actually education in and of itself is a great thing. And that's something that we need to bring back into our whole Christian ethos, how much we actually value education. But theology is just basically the study of God, his attributes, being, world, and word. And at its most basic level, I cannot think of anything that does not involve theology. So it's a really, really good idea for you as a Christian to get theology, for you as a lawyer to get theology, for you as a politician to grasp some theology. I want to ask, what is society? The only way I can put it is very simple for me. It's the community of people interacting with one another. It's the idea of, in Greek, the polis. Now, in Scotland, we speak a kind of English. Polis is the way that we would say police. You know? So society is not the polis, it's not the police, but the polis is the community of people. Now, what I find interesting in modern day European society, I'm just going to throw things out all the time, by the way, that you want to pick up on. My methodology is always fling out grenades to people and plant them in their brains, and then you'll be lying awake at night one night, you'll be asleep, and suddenly this will go off. Wait, did he say that? How does that mean? Well, here's one in terms of society. I think that in Europe, bizarrely, although we talk about society, we are in enormous danger of atomizing into different networks and different groups. That actually, because of the internet, it's so much easier for you to pick and choose your friends according to people who think like you. And it's very easy, if you're a doctor, only to mix with doctors. If you're a right-wing politician, only to mix with other people who share your same viewpoint. In fact, that's one of the great barriers we have in communicating the Christian gospel, because so many people are just not listening and not talking and not having the conversation. Society consists of humans, from a Christian perspective, who are fundamentally equal. What Christianity brought in was the Greco-Roman world said society was a hierarchical structure. But what Christianity said was, well, what if society is a collection of individuals who are all equally made in the image of God? What if the slave has a soul that's as valuable as the emperor's? Now, we so take that for granted that we don't realize how radical that actually is. And my belief is it took about 300 or 400 years for that to permeate European society. But it's beginning to shift out. The whole concept of the Untermenschen, the whole idea of if you're Roma, somehow you're less significant as a human being. It's not just in terms of racism, but everything else. Now, Christianity just doesn't allow that. Christianity, to put it at its bluntest, does not allow me to walk down the street to see a man lying in his own urine, drunk out his head, and going, ah, he's just scum. He's not. He's somebody made in the image of God, which is what's happening to him, what makes what's happening to him so tragic. The radical thing in terms of society that Jesus changed is that the individual replaces the family as the instrument of immortality. Let me just go on to a quote I want to give you. This is from Sidney. So in Paul's writing, we see the emergence of a new sense of justice founded on the assumption of moral equality rather than on natural inequality. Justice now speaks to an upright will rather than describing a situation where everything is in its proper or fated place. Paul's conception of the Christ exalts the freedom and power of human agency when rightly directed. In his vision of Jesus, Paul discovered a moral reality which enabled him to lay the foundation for a new universal social role. In ancient society, the family was the cultus. It was the center of worship. I don't know if any of you have this custom, but in Britain, they have this idea of carrying, when you get married, getting your bride and carrying her over the threshold of the door, over the hearth. That comes from Greco-Roman pagan world, because the idea was you were taking the woman and she was becoming part of your cult, because you had a family shrine. Now, that changed because you ended up having city shrines and cities became the really, really important thing. But what Christianity did was it blew both those apart. Ironically, Christianity destroyed the concept of the family at one level. At another level, we'll see that it didn't quite do that. But sticking with what is society, society consists of human beings who have a will, a moral responsibility, and are at core sinful. Now, again, you'll find in our culture, there's a pressure being pushed to say that's not the case. For example, if you're a genetic determinist, you're going to assume, well, people behave that way because it's in their genes. Everything that happens is foreordained by our genes. And ultimately, no one's responsible. I raped that woman because it's genetic. How can I be to blame? I have no free will. And that obviously impacts law and politics. Augustine is so vital in this. I did a politics degree at university, I actually got thrown out of it for arguing so much, but I went on and just did a history one. But part of it was, I was amazed, our lecturer gave the 10 most influential books in the history of the world. And two of them were from Augustine. Augustine's Confessions and Augustine's City of God. And actually, the City of God is the foundational document for contemporary European politics, in my view. It's notion of there being two different spheres of authority, but particularly about the will. Augustine says this, is a great quote, "My mind, questioning itself upon its own powers, feels that it cannot rightly trust its own report." See, Augustine taught human beings had a mind, but our minds were not absolute. You couldn't absolutely trust reason because our reasons are limited. Our new fundamentalist atheists go, "Well, if it's not reasonable to me, it doesn't exist." And you go, "You arrogant person. What makes you think that your mind is so vast and so brilliant?" But that's one of the fundamental beliefs that we have to get people to question. Christians will come with, I hope, a certain amount of humility. We don't have pride in our own ability. We don't have pride that if we're elected, things can only get better. Hubris always leads to downfall. We are all equally sinful. And you can either go to Augustine or Kant, as well as to the Bible, to find that. And again, that's hugely important. The concept of sin is vital for politics, and it is vital for law as well. Church-society relations. Look at more of this when we look at the politics thing. But again, let me just simply throw some things out. First of all, how Christianity changed things. The early church was marginal. I was listening to one of our ministers who is, I'm not allowed to say his name, in fact I'm not even allowed to say the country he's from, but let's say he's from a Middle East country. And last week he was telling us that 90% of what God does is done without publicity. How did God manage without Facebook and the internet? Well, he still does. It goes on under the radar. I mean, imagine when the CIM missionaries were thrown out of China when Mao Zedong came to power. And we were all going in the West, "Oh, that's terrible, there'll be no church in China, and how will they do without us?" And there was about maybe 500,000 Chinese Christians. When the missionaries got back in, there was 50 million. See, God works in lots and lots of different ways, and a lot of it is under the radar. And in the early church, it was marginal. It didn't shout about being marginal. But because of that, benefited from having a lot of women and a lot of slaves who ended up turning the world upside down. I think also, in terms of society, one of the big changes that Christianity brought in, and again, it's something that you just assume, but we don't take on board. Before Christianity came in, work was something that was disgraceful. Work was not honored. It was an ethic just for slaves. But now, work was given a new dignity and respect. You can call it the Protestant work ethic, but existed before that as well. I find it interesting that in our culture, we are moving more and more away from the idea of work as being something respectable and something conveying dignity. Instead, what's happening is the idea is you win the lottery, and then you get a life of bliss doing nothing, except doing nothing is not bliss. And we've created a whole workless society, both at the upper end in the uber rich and at the lower end in the unemployed, who are, I can think of one woman in my own church who, since she's 21 years old and she's now double that age, has been living off welfare and so on. And for her to get a job with no skills and no experience right now is impossible, because in order for her to get what she's getting through welfare, she would have to have a job with £25,000 a year. And there's no chance of her getting that. So she's, for the rest of her life, is condemned to be without work. And in her head, she has this ethos, "Well, so what?" And I'm going, it's dignity. My father grew up in a tradition where he would rather work for pennies than have millions and not be able to do work. And Christianity changed that ethic. I would argue also, as I said, that Christianity destroyed the family as a center for worship, but created the modern family in terms of marriage, and in particular in terms of conjugal rights, that men and women within marriage were equal. Now, before that, they weren't. And incidentally, if you destroy marriage in the name of sexual equality, you are going to end up destroying sexual equality. if you destroy the Christian doctrine of marriage. I would argue that it empowered women by protecting them from abuse within marriage. And that's right from the beginning. And I would argue, of course, that the freed slaves. Aristotle, great Greek philosopher, what did he say? Some are free men and some are slaves by nature. Christianity totally tore that apart. Let's do a little bit on theology and the law. What is law? Application of the morals and principles of society to the whole body politic. Codified rules to guide and govern. I have a huge amount of stuff on Christ the Christian and the law, but I'm not going to use it because I said I'd finish at 11 and because that's all theology, and actually because some of it you can get if you watch that thing online. But it's very interesting, the concepts of law and what is involved. However, I do want to suggest that the law is designed to give freedom. We drove here from the airport. The law says that you drive, now I need to get this right, on the right-hand side of the road. The proper side of the road to drive is really the left-hand side, but you drive on the right-hand side of the road. Suppose you say, I don't need that law, I'm totally free to drive on whatever side of the road I want. Then people don't have freedom to go places because they end up killing each other. Law ultimately gives freedom, and I'm going to stress that. I'm just going to list a number of things and we can discuss these. Number one is freedom of religion. Let me give you a quote. We worship the one God. In fact, let me see if I've got it here. Yeah, from Tertullian. We worship the one God. There are others you regard as God. We know them to be demons. Nevertheless, it is a basic human right that everyone should be free to worship according to his own convictions. No one is either harmed or helped by another man's religion. Religion must be practiced freely, not by coercion. Even animals for sacrifice must be offered with a willing heart. You know what's fascinating in this? The whole idea of freedom of religion is entirely a Christian concept. In theory, it exists in Islam until you go to an Islamic country. Freedom of religion stems from the fact that Christianity in the first centuries never advanced by force, but always by persuasion. And if you look at the history of Islam, it's entirely different. Entirely different. So one of the things that we are genuinely arguing for is freedom of religion. Peter Hitchens, the brother of Christopher, once said to me, and he said this in other places as well, he said, the worst place to be an atheist is in an atheist country. The best place to be an atheist is in a Christian country. And I would say virtually the same of any other religion and philosophy. Secondly, I want to argue that law is by definition moral. If the material is all there is, then the law is entirely arbitrary. But Christianity taught that there was a moral law, and from that moral law, all other laws are bound. The law of God is revealed, it is written on our hearts, and it is reasoned. And ultimately, all law stems from that. So, you then end up with someone like Samuel Rutherford, the Scottish Puritan in the 17th century, writing a book called Lex Rex. The law is king. He didn't write Rex Lex. The king is the law. There was a move in Europe at that time, including the kings of Scotland and England and France and elsewhere, to say, actually, I'm the king, I'm the law, I'm the representative of God. And people like Rutherford stood up and said, no way, no way, the law is the king. Now, incidentally, we Scots like to claim absolutely everything. It's on that basis that United States of America was formed. We invented America, so just remember you owe us, those of you who are from America. You know, you invented string cheese, we invented you. Also, if you look at how canon law developed in medieval Europe, canon law became the basis of our modern legal system. And again, I can't go into that. I don't know enough about it, well, for one reason, but I think there is plenty of evidence for it. Another thing is that Christianity recognizes the limitation of law. So, for example, the whole concept of thought crime. No. We believe there's a God who will judge. In fact, I think it was Abelard who suggested that even if you had evidence that someone was preparing to commit a crime, you couldn't charge them with it because they hadn't actually done it. That's an interesting, there's a big argument about that. But it's interesting, in our society, we are going to move, because of an absolutist state, to the notion that even thinking the wrong things is a crime. But in Christianity, we say no, because we believe there's an ultimate judge. If you don't believe there's an ultimate judge, then of course you have to judge everything now. But we don't. I know somebody who was accused of adultery. People say, well, what do you think? Do you think this? Do you think that? And I go, I don't know. I'm not God. How do I know? But there is a God who will judge. And unless I've got evidence, I can't say anything. But I leave that up to God. So Christianity recognizes the limitation of law. Christianity also teaches free will and moral responsibility. In our society, we're moving towards genetic determinism or social determinism. And the key battle for those of you who are involved in law is going to hold on to the moral responsibility. It's like we have wee children go, it wasn't me. This is a very Scottish phrase. It was not me. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. It was the devil made me do it. You know, it was my friend. It was this. It's the English. It's the Germans. It's, you know, it's the Russians. I don't know. It's space invaders, whoever. It's not me. And the Bible goes, yeah, it is you. Actually, it is. You do have responsibility. Even if what happened to you was horrible, even if you had a rotten background, you are a human being. I'll give you one classic example of how that works. No, I won't. I'll give you that during the questions. Christians believe in natural rights more than natural law. And that's also important. We believe in natural rights. The language of rights, a lot of Christians back off from it. Don't back off from it. It's like equality and tolerance. Don't let the devil take these words. Take them back, rebaptize them, as Paul did with the Greek language. But we do believe in natural rights. Why? Because the incarnation, God with us. Jesus became a human being. Because of that, we are all as human beings affected, and I think we all have natural rights. The Son of God did not come as a dog or a cat or a cockroach. There is a difference between you and a cockroach. In atheistic thought, there isn't. Ultimately, there isn't. It cannot be. Logically. But in Christian thought, there's a profound difference. Then there arises the question, if Christianity says that all humans are created equal in the sight of their creator, then they should be equal in the eyes of the law. Hugely important. Again, see how that's being challenged today. In Britain, libel law, you can libel people, you can sue for libel if you're very wealthy. But what if you're very poor? There's a whole range of things where the whole legal system is being tilted towards the wealthy. And that is a fundamentally anti-Christian concept. Then, let me just finish off by saying something about theology and politics. Politics, the government of the polis, as I said, the community. Now, the fascinating thing here is, in the ancient community, if you were in Athens or Corinth or even Jerusalem or Rome, then you would see patriotism as the supreme virtue. You'd be devoted to your city, you'd be devoted to the fatherland or to the motherland. Piety and patriotism are the same, and it's a fatal combination. You see it in Ukraine and Russia. You saw it in Nazi Germany. And I want to venture to say you will see it more and more in Serbia and England and Scotland and elsewhere. Because people's identity is sometimes seen in their nationality. In the ancient world, to be without patriotism was to be anything less than an active citizen was to be an idiot. The original word, idiotus, just simply means that, someone who's not a citizen. To be in exile was a worse punishment than death. And you don't understand ancient culture unless you see that. But in Christianity, we don't say that. We don't have the city or the nation state as the absolute. Is the kingdom of God political? Yeah. Yes and no. First of all, the key fundamental here is Augustine's two cities, the split between powers. Before this, all authority was unitary. All authority was invested in the state or the household. But now, there are two kingdoms, Caesar's and God's. I think we're heading back to a unitary authority. I think we're heading back to an all-powerful state. I think when the church took morality away from the state, it was a great thing. And now that the state has taken morality back, it's a disaster. And it will inevitably lead to authoritarianism. Kings and emperors were desacralized. They were no longer considered holy. As we re-sacralize the state and replace God with the state in whatever form, whether it's the multi-state state, whether it's the city-state, we are going to find that by definition, those in control of the state will be those who exercise authority and power, and the rest will be Untermenschen. I would argue that equality inevitably leads to representative democracy, and that Christian theology is essential for equality, which is why George Bush and Tony Blair and so on were so stupid. If only they had some theology, it would really have helped them before they went to war in Iraq, seeking to impose a democracy upon a nation state and a people who had no real concept or framework for democracy. Islam needs its reformation before you will properly have democracy. Democracy within Europe is dependent upon the notion of equality, and equality is dependent on the notion of a Christian understanding of humanity. I would argue that Christianity is for the poor. I'll give you just a quote here. Bishop Theodulf of Orleans stated this. This is, I think, the 12th century. This is about the poor. Their sweat and toil makes you rich. The rich get their riches because of the poor, but nature submits you to the same laws. In birth and death you are alike. The same holy water blesses you. You are anointed with the same oils. The flesh and blood of the Lamb, the Christ, nourishes you all together. I would argue, of course it's going to happen, that the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to get poorer if we reject Christianity. That's human nature. Christianity challenges that and changes that. Ironically, of course, you're going to get all kinds of liberal Christians and others keep yakking about the poor and doing nothing about it. Not really. You've got to talk about it, you know. And isn't it interesting how in our culture equality is now no longer about economic justice, equality is now about sexuality. We have something in Scotland called the Equality Network. The only thing they campaign for is homosexuality. The only thing. Now, there's something vastly wrong in that. Pietists, Erastians, and politicians. Let's just say, for me, different Christian ways of looking at things. The Pietists are the people who go, well, let's just go for heaven. Let's not bother about it. Let's lock ourselves away in our wee ship until Jesus comes and takes us all up to heaven. Let the world just go to hell, literally. I'm sorry. That's just entirely wrong. The Erastians are the people who want the state to control the church, or even you can go vice versa. You could have the church trying to control the state, kind of what I would call the theonomic viewpoint. No, I want to argue this. The more you are aware of Christ, the more you know his word, the more you know theology, the more use you will be in this world, the freer you will be to serve everybody. Where do we go with all of this? Question mark. Well, let me give you this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, I'm going to exercise my liberty because time's up. I'm going to take 2 more minutes. Okay. really, we hold these truths to be self-evident. To who? How are these truths self-evident? Ask. They are only self-evident in the context of a Christian framework. They are not self-evident out with that framework. It is only the Puritans who went on the Mayflower and people who are descended from them who could say this. Now people are going, well, we hold them to be self-evident. You go, why? What's the basis? What's the reason? And because we don't have a solid theology and philosophy, people can't really answer that. Here's the thing that I think will shock you. Modern liberalism and secularism have Christian roots. And we should actually argue for Christian versions of both of them. Don't fall into the trap of saying we're against liberalism, because when you hear that language being spoken, you see, liberal to me carries the idea of open and generous and kind and so on. And when you say, I'm against liberalism, people are hearing you say, well, I'm a nasty, mean, right-wing fundamentalist, you know, Neanderthal caveman. That's what they think. But in actual fact, proper liberalism is stemmed in Christian roots, and without it, It becomes an authoritarianism. Same way with secularism. With secularism, we're saying, no, the church, we don't want the church to run the state. My goodness, have you seen my Kirk session? We can't even run ourselves. We don't want to run the city. We really don't. The church is a mess. We agree with that. But you can't have a proper secularism without a Christian foundation. That's what I'm saying. I want to argue that the 18th century Enlightenment or 17th century Enlightenment was not so enlightened. It denatured God and deified nature. That's a very important thing. Karl Becker, 1932, historian, said this, that the 18th century Enlightenment denatured God and deified nature. Sidenthorpe finishes off with this. If Europeans understand secularism in the term favored by its critics as mere consumerism, materialism, and amorality, they lose touch with their own moral intuitions. They forget why they value freedom. We need to bring people back to the moral depth of our own tradition. Only then can we see real progress. Otherwise, unless you guys get it together and get out there and change things, what's going to happen is instead of progressing onto a secular nirvana, we're going to regress to a Greco-Roman pagan view of the world with all that that means. Now, the church flourished within that society, but it flourished and changed it. We need the church to flourish again, and we need the society to be changed. So I'm going to leave it there. You talk about broad sweep. That's absolutely massive, and there's loads of stuff. So honestly, if you haven't got questions and you can't talk about that, then just pack up and go home. it's a waste of time you being here. So, yeah. All right, choose. On you go. Can you say your name again, just so for benefit? Yeah, thank you. The Roman society thing. Yeah, we're looking at the whole question of Roman society, and we're saying, look, you look at Spartacus, and you'll see what that is. Of course, it's a dramatization. But read any ancient Roman histories or anything as well, and you'll see what's involved. I wish I could remember the book. It's one of those things that I read, and then it made a big impact on me, such a big impact I've forgotten the name and the author. But I remember it was fascinating because it was saying, look what happened in Roman society. What did they do? They glorified the human body. What was really important? The gym. Well, look at what we're getting back to. The gym is really important. Entertainment was vital. The gap between rich and poor. In the city of Rome, there were more than 500,000 people who were starving, literally, in famine, and there were people who were bathing in asses' milk and having gold baths. We're getting back to that. As a culture, we're getting back to that. So I think, grasping and understanding that is really important. You know, just take that as a little mantra. When our European, inverted commas, liberals talk about being progressive, and I don't know about your country, but my country, every politician has to say they're progressive. And I'm going, no, you idiots, you're regressive. You're regressing back. You're not progressing forward. I don't quite express it in such strong terms usually, but... Yeah, if we're... Right, okay. Let me understand what you're saying. You're saying if we revert back to the Roman culture or Roman society, then ultimately that will end up in a reset anyway because you'll end up with not enough food being distributed and, you know, there'll be trouble and riots and all that kind of stuff.
And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to stop that, but that is an argument that could be used.
Yeah, it's an argument that could be used, and it's an argument that historically could be defended, but it's an argument that's a little bit too simplistic. I mean, I can tell you where you'll see that happening. For a start, you see that happening in Eastern European countries like Hungary, where far-right groups will get more and more power precisely because many people see the whole system as having failed them. It's why the Front National in France will probably do very well today. You know, it's why 1 million people in Britain voted for a fascist, racist party, the BNP, at the last European elections. 1 million people voted for a fascist party. I mean, I couldn't believe it, but that's what happened. And what will happen is both extreme left and extreme right, though, to be honest, extreme left is not all that much different from extreme right. They're kind of... They're far away in straight line, but in a circle, they're right next to each other. So I think you could see a little bit of that happening. There's a danger that, basically you're saying, if the economy collapses, there's a push towards authoritarianism. And I would argue, absolutely, if there is no break in culture in terms of Christianity. And that would be my whole point. So I think you're right in that. But the other thing is, I think, just think of Marie Antoinette. Let them eat cake. The bottom line is, it's not just food, it's entertainment. And we live in a culture where I know people who live in relative poverty who don't have carpets and who don't get 3 square meals, but who have a 42-inch square television. And, you know, they're being fed this garbage all the time, that life is about sex and drugs and 15 minutes of fame on reality TV. And you're going, no, no. So there's almost a sense in which what our elites are doing is they're saying to the poor, you're pretty well worthless, to be honest. Just get on and, you know, have this stuff. Whereas us, you know, we can have the best schools and we can have the best of this and the best of that. And I think this is where the Christian value of education comes in. The best way you will help the poor anywhere, in any society, anywhere in the world, is education. Absolutely. I believe that with all my heart. I think, and that's one of the great gifts that the Christian church brought. We didn't just educate the wealthy. We educated everybody. And that's what we should look for. You know. So, yes, there's truth in what you're saying, but for me it's more complex. Yes, sir. Well, let's do your first one, because I can. Lack of interest in theology is a proxy, like, for example, history and other things. Well, that's because, as a theologian, I'm saying theology is everything. You know, it's a bit, Scottish people do this. Anything good comes from Scotland, so we can manage to go in two leaps, we can get you there. And it's the same way with theology. I mean, I'm a historian, and I would say, yeah, well, of course, history is his story. You know, I can, you know, philosophy, everything. So yes, you're absolutely right that one of the sad things in our culture is the dumbing down of society. Now, the interesting thing, what I'm not saying is that everyone has to be an academic. I've met some pretty dumb academics as well. As my mom would say, they're no wise. You know, it's the dumbing down of society. It's saying to people, you can't think, don't bother, we'll do your thinking for you. It's like these dreadful Hollywood films that don't only do your thinking for you, they do your feeling for you, because they play the music that expresses how you're supposed to feel. And you think, no, I've got a heart and I've got a brain myself, thank you. I can think it through. I mean, I can contrast two films. One is Godzilla, which I saw 2 weeks ago, and another was A Thousand Times Goodnight, which is a Norwegian-Irish film. Now, Godzilla, if you like special effects and big bangs and, you know, go for it. If you like humanity, any sort of genuine storyline and any depth of character and insight, then don't bother. I mean, you might your chair is going to get as much out of Godzilla as you are. But A Thousand Times Goodnight is just a phenomenal thing, because it poses questions about war in Afghanistan and Africa and family relationships in Ireland, which I was just completely traumatized by it. And I'm thinking, why is it, as human beings, why have we moved towards this brain-dead culture? And we're saying, okay, for some people, that's fine. I'm saying for nobody, it's fine. You know, I'm not saying everyone has to be academic. They don't have to all be into art noir films and jazz and so on. But I'm saying everyone can think. And Christianity always taught that. Let this mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. Your mind should be renewed. My father comes from a tradition where he was a farm laborer in the north of Scotland. He left school when he was 12. You go into his house now, it's the same as it's always been. There are books by Martin Lloyd-Jones and Spurgeon and Calvin and so on. And I go and teach at universities, and there are medical students going, keep it simple for us, eh? We don't want to, keep our theology simple. I'm going, no way, no way, think. So yes, I think you're right, it's a general thing. Your second thing, sorry. The question is, which institutions do we try and build first, say, in the context of a country like Ukraine? To me, the most important thing in Ukraine today is not the elections. The most important thing today are the churches who are proclaiming and living Jesus Christ. Because until you have people who have Jesus Christ, you can have any system that you want. It doesn't matter. Capitalism without Christ is a disaster. Socialism without Christ is a disaster. Whatever ism it is, without Christ is a disaster. So you actually need more Christians. Vishal Mangalwandi, I think it's on the sheet that you've got. In fact, I know it's on the sheet that you got. His book, The Book That Made Your World. If there's one book I would urge you to read, it would be that one. Now, Vishal Mangalwandi is an Indian guy. And in that book, he tells a story of, he says, why is there no ice cream in India? And I was just so fascinated with the title. Because I was thinking, oh man, that's one place I'd want ice cream. And he talks about how when he went to the Netherlands the first time, And he went with a friend to get some milk. And they went to a farm. And they went in the farm and in the barn or whatever. It was one of these typical Dutch farmhouses. Some of it was a house and some of it was, for cattle and so on. And they went in the part that was for cattle and there was milk there. And he took a churn of milk. His friend took a churn of milk and left the money on the counter and walked away. And Vishal said, "What are you doing? You're taking the milk." He said, "Yeah." "And you're leaving money?" "Yeah, I'm paying for it." "Why? What do you think?" You know, sorry, forgive me, those of you who are Dutch, for being so stereotypical. I love the Dutch because the Dutch are so direct. You know, the subtlety doesn't really come into their... We use the phrase, subtle as a flying mallet. That's for me, that's the Dutch. Even more so than the Germans. And I'm sorry about the racial stereotypes, but that's just my experience. And he says, "Yeah, of course. Why not?" And Vishal started thinking about it, and he writes about it in this way. He says, "Why can they do that in the Netherlands?" He says, "In India, you couldn't do that. In India, the farmer would milk the cow, would have the milk, but he couldn't leave it, so he'd have to sell it to a shop, or he'd have to employ someone, so the price of the milk goes up. But then the government want to be involved, because they're selling it to a shop, so they have to have an inspector. Then you have to pay a bribe to the inspector. And then, and basically, the milk becomes so expensive, you can't afford to make ice cream. And what's the difference? Why is India, which is one of the most wealthiest nations in terms of natural resources, one of the poorest countries in the world? And why is Holland, which, to be honest, is flat and drowned and shouldn't really exist, you know, at one level, why did it become one of the wealthiest, the most successful? In fact, in I'm sure you know this, but in world terms, the World Health Organization now classes the healthiest nations by their height. And by that, the Dutch are the most healthy people in the world. You know, you're under 6 foot, you're a dwarf in Holland. But why is Holland so successful? And the answer is because of the Christian ethos, the Protestant work ethic, and everything else that comes from that. So back to your comment and your question, just give me an honest lawyer. In a corrupt system, it's going to be really hard. An honest politician in a corrupt system, it's going to be really hard. But eventually, the weight of numbers will overcome that. Now, what we're going to need is we're going to need our pioneers. We're going to need people who can reform the whole system. But if you reform the system without reforming the people, you're just creating another corrupt system. It's not going to work. I would argue for both. Okay, that's really important. And again, I'll repeat it. The thinking about the concept of sin, and from a secular humanist point of view, it doesn't really exist, and so on. In theory, yes. If you are a middle-class Western European liberal, sin is just something you hear about other people doing. In reality, every state, every society has its own sins. You go into a school in Britain and you're racist, you're done. If I go into a school in Britain now and say I think homosexuality is sinful or wrong, I'm out. You know, we are not a pluralistic society. The thing is, never take secularists for real in terms of what they're actually saying, because they don't believe in a pluralistic society. It's actually an extremely narrow society. There's a sense in which once you remove the law of God, you end up creating a million other laws. It becomes more and more inflexible and intolerant. The concept of sin means that politicians and lawyers see themselves as restraining. Not curing. We can't cure people from sin. The state thinks it can. But we can't. We know that Christ can. But that what we are trying to do is restrain. So that within that peaceful society, the gospel can be proclaimed.
Dominate for them to come up.
Yes. Yeah. That's a brilliant point. And the point is, and I'll repeat it again just for benefit of recording it, is example of Ukraine. If we just go in and say, bring European values, to be honest, it sounds a bit imperialistic and arrogant. Wouldn't it be better to look at stuff that's there anyway? And here's the genius of Christianity. We're not saying bring European values. We're saying what you admire in Western Europe or Eastern Europe that is good actually comes from Christianity. But Christianity comes from the Middle East. And what we're saying is that there's a lot of things that are wrong in Western Europe. I can't tell people how to live their lives or do their own countries, but when I go to a country, I look instantly for what's local and what's there. And I was in Ukraine last year, and so many things I loved. There's some Ukrainian poets, There's a whole history in terms of the church. I mean, I studied the Vikings, who, of course, the Rus, who founded Russia and Kiev and so on. And I think you can go back into any nation in Europe, any nation, East or West, and point to aspects of their history that stem from Christianity and say, how come we've lost this? What's happened here? So I would actually say, no, we can have Russian values as well as Western European, and as well as, because we're saying we're not looking for these, we're looking for what comes from God. And I think one of the things we would do as Western Europeans is go and say, look, we've really screwed things up. We've got a lot of things wrong. And part of it is because we have moved away. I mean, the sheer arrogance of someone like Hillary Clinton going to nations in Africa and saying, you've got to accept this on abortion, you've got to accept it because these are progressive liberal values and you're all going to become like that. It's the arrogance of the Oxford elitist, Richard Dawkins, who believes fundamentally that actually Africans are quite backward. And people in other countries, the epitome of civilization is, you know, middle class England. Or if I was an arrogant Scotsman, which is an impossible contradiction in terms, of course, you could say this, we'd use the phrase, fuzz like us. Who's going to, you know, you want to be like us. We're actually, if you've got a good Christian theology, you're saying we're all screwed. We're all in a mess. We all get things wrong. None of our societies is perfect, and none of them are progressing and advancing towards this nirvana. But so that's where the Christian theology comes in. It protects you from going to a place like Ukraine and saying, well, look, become like France or England or Germany or Scotland. No, don't. We don't want that. But look at what's good. and it's more than materialism, and it's more than amorality. So that's a hugely important thing. Somebody was, yeah. and then we...
My name is Gabri. And some people say, maybe true, that the values, the most important values in our society came from the Christian philosophy. But they say there is no need for this philosophy anymore because we can keep them only because they are efficient from economic point of view or social point of view.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is wrong?
Well, okay, again, just simply that people think it's okay, we accept they came from Christianity, like science. Most historians of science will accept that modern-day science comes from Christianity, but they'll say we've outgrown that now, we've matured. and they will say, fair enough, we accept that, but now we'll keep these values because they work and because economically they're advantageous that you don't go around stealing things and so on. My simple answer to that is, without roots, you get no fruits. It's as simple as that. Well, it's a law of nature. The minute you detach something from its root, it will die. The appearance will stay, but it will die. And I would argue the evidence for that when these people are saying this, they are putting a faith in humanity which has no evidence whatsoever. I was asked by a man I was doing a discussion in a bookshop once, and this guy said, Dave, I like you. You seem a great guy, and he obviously had good taste. And he said... But he said, I don't understand, you have a rotten view of human beings. He says, I have to believe that human beings are good. He said, do you have any evidence for that? I said to him, do you have any evidence for that? He said, no, but do you have any evidence they're bad? I said, yes. He said, prove it. I said, sure. There's the history section, choose me any book. Any book you like in that history section. And I'll show you that human beings are screwed up. You know, there's a guy, Freddie Mercury of Queen, who did, what was it called? Live Aid. And he came out onto Live Aid to sing a song with Queen, and we started off with the acoustic guitar, and I thought, oh no, here we go. If there's a God up above, a God of love, and I was waiting to hear, you know, what's he doing about all this starvation? And instead, he sang, then what must he think of the mess that we've made of the world that he created? And I think that's axiomatic. Across the world, you can show that human beings screw up. I'm a pastor in a local church. I enjoy being that. I have to be that in terms of apologetics for me, because every day I see sin. And I tell you this, where I see sin the most, when I look in a mirror and when I look within myself. And that's, again, where Augustine was so spot on. Human beings are moral, they are responsible, but they are weak. I'm aware that people say it's another step in evolution, and I'm aware that they say that we can choose. And my challenge to them is very simple then. I'll give them a very practical one. I'd say, okay, I'm going to give you a week. You can choose, can you, whether you do good or evil? Yes, absolutely. Okay, I give you 1 week. Go away, come back to me in 1 week and tell me within that week, honestly, if you have said, done, or thought anything but evil. And I will guarantee not one person can come back and say that. But why? Do they want to do evil? No. It's our nature. So I think we've got history, we've got philosophy, we've got psychology, we've got humanity, we've got absolutely every bit of evidence on the biblical understanding of it. When people are saying that, I accept they believe it, but it is a blind faith. It is a totally blind faith without any evidence. G.K. Chesterton, Roman Catholic writer, once said the easiest doctrine in the world to prove, and said, in fact, the only doctrine in the Bible that you can prove is the doctrine of original sin. Okay, I'm going to take two more because we're going to have to stop, but I'll take these two. But you are correct. Ravi Zacharias continually points out that going throughout the world, the number one problem that people identify is corruption. If you've got corruption in a society, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. Sorry if you're Danish, just a quote. But if you've got corruption, no matter what system you've got, you're stuffed.
It's so opposed to what we stand for.
Well, Tertullian's a great one. He says, these are doctrines of demons. He's not being subtle. I think Islam is fundamentally from the devil, to be honest. And I should have the freedom to say that. I think in the postmodern marketplace of ideas, you put Christianity in there, it's going to shine out above everything else. We don't need force. We don't need compulsion. So what we do is, my neighbor next door is called Mohammed, so that gives you a wee clue about where he's, you know, where he's from. He gives us Eid cards and Christmas cards, and you know we respond giving food and all that kind of stuff. I pray that the prayer tent that they put up when they have their festival, sometimes my wife prays, she said, once, I'm praying that there's going to be thunder and lightning, and it's going to be, and I said, oh, animal, that's not very nice. Well, lo and behold, there was thunder and lightning, and they had to take it down, which was, I thought, well, maybe she's taught me a lesson. I think we fight not with the weapons of this world, but spiritual weapons. True freedom of religion means that we have the right to criticize other religions as well, and they have the right to critique us. When our culture, when in Western Europe just now, what's happening is people are saying, oh, no, no, if you criticize Islam, that's racism or Islamophobia. And suddenly freedom of religion is not there because I've got to be free to be criticized and also to criticize, to discuss. So I think a Christian view would be genuinely tolerant. Last question.
Or you tend to imply that a nation, in order for a nation to be successful, you necessarily need God.
Yes.
However, I would like to state the fact that there's a really huge difference between the spiritual world and our spiritual future with God.
Yeah.
And this life here. And
yeah.
Not always. And God has, throughout the history, allowed successful nations exist in a successful way. But this not necessarily implies that God agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a big question. And I know the time's up, and I know you're desperate for coffee, but indulge me for 2-3 minutes, because that's such a great question. You know, Japan and other countries, so you know that. Right, first of all, it depends how you define success. I don't define success in terms of material prosperity. And I think you have to be really careful about a kind of health and wealth teaching. If we do this, then God will bless us. I think America could end up being one of the most godless nations in the world and one of the most successful materialistically. At least in the short term. At least in the short term. I think your point about Japan is really interesting. I know plenty of people in Japan who are desperate to get out because they find the whole culture incredibly stifling. It's incredibly oppressive towards women. They've adopted the capitalist system from the US and mixed it in with the Shintoism and the absolute determinism and so on. It's the reason why people are handing things back. I could tell you that right now in Japan, just now, there's a real problem with something like 20 million young men who don't go out and meet with anyone because they're in with their computers. Some are even applying to marry their avatar on their computer. I mean, I think Japan is a mess of a society. And I wouldn't put it forward as successful. Yes, materialistically at one level. So you can certainly have that. But I'm saying what's good within European society that we value, the freedom, the tolerance, the equality, the diversity. You don't get those in Japan. I would argue that they stem from Christianity. And that's what we should, you know, we should be passionate advocates of equality and diversity and so on. Not in the modern liberal secular sense, but in the traditional Christian sense. I would also say there is a danger in you saying spiritual, this world, next world. It obviously impacts. It totally impacts. I'll leave you with this one example. There's a guy we call the £2 million junkie. He was a junkie. He cost the state £2 million in Britain because since he was 16 till the age of 32, he's in and out of jail. I visited him in jail. He'd started coming to our church. He was converted. Since then, I'm not saying his life's been perfect, but he's off. He's on methadone, but he's no longer stealing cars, no longer going to jail, no longer taking drugs other than methadone. He's doing pretty well. He's saving the state a fortune. Why? Because he became a believer. And that, for me, is the ultimate thing that we're saying. We need God to work in our society, but when God does work, it changes the society. I believe in Christian chaos theory. Standard chaos theory is a butterfly flaps its wings in China and there's a hurricane in Florida. Christian chaos theory is you go home, you're speaking to somebody, they talk to someone else, they talk to someone else, they talk to someone else, they become a Christian, they meet another Christian, they eventually become president of Kenya or whatever and start changing the whole culture and society. Who knows? So, guys, you've been absolutely great. I know you need coffee, so you better go. But thank you very much. You're a stimulating bunch.